the yeah.
Next slide, Sharon. Thanks, Heather, for and Highland Institute and all the donors for making this meeting possible. I think it's important for us to get together and talk about these issues. So, Sharon just gave a great global background and with several regional examples of why we think the study ocean certification is important right now. I'm going to focus a little bit more on the Gulf of Maine. I'm a researcher at UNH. I work with a coastal carbon group that includes South Myanmar, Chris Hunt, Jim Irish, Sean Chelado, and several others. And we focus our observations, one of our projects is focusing observations in the Gulf of Maine. I want to talk about the importance of the Gulf of Maine in terms of certification. So, but I'm going to talk a little bit more about background on ocean certification and what we need to measure in the Gulf of Maine to try and understand the variability of ocean acidification. And then I want to highlight and bring home the point of why the coastal Gulf of Maine is sensitive to ocean acidification, perhaps more sensitive than other neighboring regions, and then highlight some observations in the Gulf of Maine to look at the short-term variability and show you some of the trends that we're detecting right now. Okay, so some more, I guess they're not equations, but some more concepts here. Is there a pointer on this?
Yeah, it's right. Top right.
Oh, okay. Yes. And so some of the trends for discussion, Shalyn already mentioned, but I just want to mention that as the temperature goes up, okay, so climate change, especially in the last decade, has really yanked the temperature of all waters in the Gulf of Maine up quite a bit. And this, at a given CO2, assuming that the CO2 goes up in response to the temperature, I'm sorry, at a given temperature, the pH will go up. And at a given carbon dioxide, the pH will go down, and that's not good. So this is a concept that Shalyn talked about already. PCO2 is another concept. It's an excellent parameter to measure to study the variability of acidification. And it's the partial pressure of carbon dioxide. We make a point of measuring this wherever we can and whenever we can. It's the carbon dioxide in the water. It's the concentration divided by how much will dissolve at a given temperature, pressure, and salinity. If the PCO2 goes up, the pH will go down. Matter of fact, these are so closely related that when we talk about the variability of PCO2, we can think in terms of pH. Okay, they're inversely related, and I'll show you a slide on that. As the temperature goes up, the PCO2 goes up. In the western Gulf of Maine, pH is very closely related to the PCO2. Okay, so here's 25,000 measurements off of Appledore Island, which is in southern Maine. And you can see this very close relationship between this carbon dioxide in the water going up and the pH going down. Okay, you see this range is very similar between 8.2 or 3 and 7.8, very similar to what Shalyn showed in some of her ocean slides as well. So it's a very tight relationship. We find that pH is relatively difficult to measure. It's a parameter that everybody knows about. There's several relatively inexpensive pH meters, and I know that some of these groups, these monitoring groups, are doing a good job of calibrating these sensors, but keep in mind they're very difficult to keep a very accurate reading that we need to study ocean acidification, at least in the open ocean. Okay, I want to talk about another concept here that Shalyn mentioned, because this is a parameter that relates ocean acidification to probably the growth and development of several shellfish that we're interested in. And this saturation index, we call it omega, and it is simply the concentrations of a calcium ion and the carbonate ions that Shalyn talked about, divided through by what we call a solubility product, which is a function of temperature. And in real simple terms, when this is above 1, animals can easily make their shells. This is a thermodynamically favorable situation where not a tremendous amount of energy is expended to incorporate that calcium carbonate into building an exoskeleton, if you're a clam or an oyster. If it's way above one, it's wicked easy to make a shell. That stuff is just sitting there, and it hardly takes any energy to bring that into your cell structure. When it's below one, this omega parameter becomes unstable and thermodynamically unstable, and shell material can actually dissolve. So organisms have developed mechanisms that they can use more energy to incorporate this calcium carbonate. But that's a problem with, if there's a problem with food availability or energy resources, then maybe something else in their body, like a reproductive system, may suffer from using that energy to build your shells. And that's all the biology I'm going to say today, because I'm not a biologist. So omega is affected by temperature. Higher temperatures always correspond to higher omega. And this is important to Gulf of Maine because of the temperatures that we've been experiencing in the last decade. This omega parameter varies with this carbon dioxide parameter, higher CO2, this drops. So when PCO2 goes up, that's not good for omega. And it varies with pH as well. pH goes up, omega goes up. Higher pH is good for cell fitting. So one thing I want to note here is there's a kind of an empirical threshold here of 1.6. This may be a threshold for optimal larval growth in some clams and oysters. And some work that was done in Mark Green's lab back in 2008 established this 1.6 parameter for clams, Mercenaria. And then Alan Barton, more recently, and Chalon mentioned his paper, established the same threshold, exactly the same threshold for lobsters. So keep that number in mind. And I just want to show you, Susie told me to put in a slide about measuring, what we measure in the Gulf of Maine and why it's important. And then I'll show you some data there. This is a very important parameter to measure, and unfortunately we can't measure it directly. There's no instrument right now that we can stick in the water and measure this. So what we have to do is we have to measure it indirectly using these so-called carbonate parameters. And I won't go into anything to the right of the equals signs here, but we all know what pH is, and we just said that pH can be measured fairly easily, but to get it accurate, we need to take care. Okay, so that's the parameter commonly used. We need two of these now, in addition to the temperature and salinity, to get at this omega. We can measure PCO2 really accurately. It's a relatively expensive measurement. It's going to cost $15,000 or $20,000 for an instrument that will measure it, but it's very stable and very accurate. So we like this one. We use this one. So you can take these two and you can measure omega, or you can take bottle measurements for total carbon dioxide, or also it's called dissolved inorganic carbon. And there's not instruments on the market right now that will measure this continuously, but maybe some are coming online pretty soon. They'll be quite expensive. But we measure it in our lab, and then total alkalinity. This is another carbonate parameter, and this is the one that we like to use. We like this PCO2 and total alkalinity. Total alkalinity we can get at quite accurately, and we can analyze these fairly quickly. And also there's some new instrumentation coming online to measure this automatically. So you need two of those plus temperature and salinity, and it's kind of expensive. So a lot of the monitoring groups in Casco Bay, Penobscot Bay, and in Joyce's Bay, it may be beyond your expense accounts right now, but it may be coming down to the point where you'll be able to measure this omega quite accurately soon. Okay, so I said I chose some data about this omega in the Gulf of Maine. And so this is near Appledore Island, where we've had a time series for about a decade now. We've had a really nice carbon dioxide buoy in there since 2006. And these are some data. And so we said that this 1.6 is an interesting threshold whereby below that threshold, certain organisms may not be able to grow optimally, and that's at 1.6 right there. And what you see here is an estimate of this omega parameter. You see a tremendous amount of seasonality in it, and this is measured one way in black, and these are our bottle estimates when we go out there on our boat and take samples. And then we, since 2010, we've also had a very nice pH sensor out there, but the readings are quite high. We have to adjust the pH to get back down here. But soon we'll have two continuous parameters where we'll be able to measure this omega continuously. So that was off Appledore Island. It gets a little closer to the coast where we have another lab that's measuring carbonate parameters continuously, and this is at the mouth of the Piscataqua River. And here you can see that this omega parameter, okay, it's almost always below this 1.6 threshold, and this is the time series that went from October towards the end of the year. And a lot of this is because it's colder water, but also because the carbon dioxide is high. And so you can also see the tidal signal. So you think about what our shellfish, or the shellfish that Bill Moon's hatchery, would be subjected to, and it's quite a ride up and down just daily, and also the seasonal ride that I showed you, and I'll show you a little bit more. The following slide. Okay, so why is the Gulf of Maine sensitive to ocean acidification? I said that earlier. Well, here's the list. It's cold, okay? Colder water tends to absorb more carbon dioxide. More carbon dioxide is a lower pH and a lower omega. It's fresh, okay? Fresh water tends to be more sensitive, at least the fresh waters that we have around here. Gulf of Maine is very fresh compared to neighboring regions, by the way, because we have such an influx of fresh water from the Canadian Scotia Shelf and from local watersheds as well. And fresh water tends to be easier to move around in terms of these carbon dioxide parameters. So if you tweak the system a little bit, other parameters will tweak much more easily in fresh water than in salt water. Salt water is really well buffered with this alkalinity. Okay, so it's fresh, it's cold. The fresh component is poorly buffered, particularly in the Gulf of Maine. The waters that come off our watersheds are acid. You know, we can measure in the Gulf of Maine watersheds some pHs that are down around 6 or even below. Okay? And then there's this strong seasonal productivity and mixed layer dynamics that I'll talk about in a slide in a minute. Okay, so here's a couple of model output slides from the Department of Fisheries and Oceanography in Dalhousie, up in Nova Scotia, up in this area here. And so this slide, I want to show you the Gulf of Maine, is seasonally cold, and there's these trends from north to south, but also across the Gulf as well, with these being the coldest waters in the summertime. We'd like to go swimming when it turns around 18, and you can see that this is not good swimming weather here. And so the cold water can absorb more carbon dioxide, and you can see this gradient of chilliness. Okay, so here what I have is the salinity, the saltiness of the water. It's an index of fresh water. And so this is very interesting, and this is a really important factor in the acidification or the acid dynamics in the Gulf of Maine. So we can see this large slug of water that's persistent that comes down from the St. Lawrence, and this also includes, you know, Arctic water that's coming from way up, you know, in the north, and that's fresh. And that comes down, that mixes with the St. Lawrence, which is, 20 times bigger than all the rivers that we have in the Gulf of Maine, maybe even bigger than that. And that pumps fresh water into the Gulf of Maine. But also, it's very important to notice that when the late spring and summer come up, that we have this big patch, you know, of fresh water, right where important shellfish growth occurs, right where important lobster growth occurs. And we think that the chemistry along the coast here is of this fresh water that comes off the watersheds is different and maybe even less favorable to shellfish growth than these waters over here. So fresh water, it's cold. I won't really go into this. Susie asked me to talk about a little bit about this eutrophication issue of acetic acid being added from eutrophication. But I know that Shalyn mentioned this, and Mark will probably mention this, and Joe Payne will probably mention this, so I will go on from there. But I will talk about a related phenomena whereby the Gulf of Maine is very productive and similar to near coastal regions that are eutrophying. There is this seasonal cycle of productivity and decomposition that can seasonally add a lot of acid to the water column. And so this is a diagram. It's a little complex. It's from Bozak et al. And it's used in the North Sea for an example. But what this shows is very analogous to the Gulf of Maine. So we have what's called a stratified layer, and it starts up in March or so, where the water column for the first several meters, maybe down to 20 meters or so, is fresher, and it starts to warm, and it's warmer, and the fresher water and the warmer water is more buoyant, so it stays resting up on the top there. And these are good still conditions for phytoplankton growth. So in the spring of the year, we get a tremendous phytoplankton bloom. Carbon dioxide is drawn down. Okay, so the carbon dioxide is drawn down, so the omega goes way up. So this is a real boon for any kind of shellfish that are floating in the water column. But some of this sinks, or a lot of this sinks, actually. It's not all grazed away. And it sinks down below the mixed layer where it rots, basically. It rots. And when it rots, it's, you know, these are microorganisms that are breathing, basically, and they're adding carbon dioxide into the water. And so we've got this two-layer system where it's more acidic down the bottom than it is up at the top. But what happens now is that in the fall of the year, when we start to get this mixed layer breaking apart and starting to beat down from more storms, it gets deeper and deeper and deeper, that entrains a lot of this high CO2 water back up into the mixed layer. So this becomes more acidic up here again. So this is a seasonal cycle that's very profound in the Gulf of Maine. Okay, and so, all right, so now I want to talk about some more of our observations so we can look at the variability of these acidification parameters in the Gulf. And so we had several time series observations. And so we had some carbon dioxide pH information up on the Bowden buoy there for exactly a year. And we also went way out here into, I don't show this, but this really important area that we should be monitoring. It's so-called Buoy End, which is where a lot of the water flows into the Gulf of Maine. So these source waters from offshore that really kind of set the stage for annual productivity. We need to know about that, but we don't know much about it right now. But we did have some, for two different years, we did have some measurements out there. Okay, that's called the Northern Channel. And so here is our carbon dioxide buoy. This is actually in Maine waters, I'm proud to say. I haven't been a Maine resident for the last 54 years. I'm 59 now. I moved here when I was 5, so I'm not a native. But we've had our buoy here since 2006. And we've also had an interesting benthic observatory down here in Stellwagen Bank for the last 2 years. And these data have been very exciting to try and analyze. And then some other data that I showed earlier is from this Coastal Marine Lab. And we've also got carbon dioxide and pH on the Great Bay as well up in Great Bay. And this is where I work in New Hampshire regularly, right where that lies. Okay, so here are some observations from our buoy, and so here's the pH, and what we see here is this seasonal cycle of high pH in the spring, and this is caused by this phytoplankton bloom. And so when you think about it, this is really favorable for shelled organisms, because when this phytoplankton bloom, there's plenty of food around for them too. So it's kind of a win-win situation. So the biology actually modulates the carbonate parameters, which actually can help the biology. And so it's a nice little positive feedback loop for them. And we see every year, there's a lot of variability in these peaks of pH, right? But there's definitely a seasonal cycle. You see it's lower in the wintertime, and that's because that respired water is mixing up. Yes, I only have 4 minutes? Oh, wow. Okay. Yes, I went on too far. Okay, and so here's that omega parameter. So what it's really, because we have all this variability, it's really difficult to see if there's trends. You know, it's unlike maybe the Hawaiian Ocean Time series or the Bermuda Ocean Time series, where they have a lot less variability than we do here in the Gulf of Maine. But nevertheless, that doesn't keep us from trying to get these trends out. So what we've done is we've mathematically taken out the seasonal time signals, and we've plotted what's called the residual of this. And it's a fairly robust mathematical treatment of this. And what we see here in the last 8 years is a definite decrease. Well, I say a definite. You can see what the error terms are. A decrease in pH, so the pH is down with fairly big error term here. We can see that the carbon dioxide is up 1.2 microatmospheres or parts per million per year. We have a time series that's been going on since the 1950s that measures carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. And during the same interval of the buoy, it's gone up about twice as much as the CO2 in the ocean here. But it's going up. It's going up. We started to detect this. And this omega, which is really interesting, also went up. And keep in mind, higher omega is good for shellfish. And the reason this is because we have had such warm temperatures. We've had this 0.2 degrees Celsius increase in sea surface temperature per year, which is absolutely astonishing, you know, for, you know, think about it. In 10 years, it would go up 2 degrees. In 100 years, it would go up 20. You know, water would be boiling by the time your great-great-great-great-grandchildren are here. So this has gone up. So this kind of highlights the interplay of warming and cooling and this carbon dioxide that is going up. And both of these signals are really small compared to this interannual variability. Remember that I said fresh water can change the acidification. Okay, temperature can change the acidification. All these things can be impacted by climate change and are impacted by climate change, all at different time scales, too. Okay, and so let me just show you one example of this shorter term time variability, because we thought it was really interesting. So shorter time scale variability in PCO2 and omega and pH, change in salinity, temperature, productivity, and mixing, I'll change that. So I'll skip this slide and I'll just get to this one. Okay, so what I'm showing here is our data from the surface off of Appledore Island in red. And this was in 2012. I don't have 2012 listed here. So it's January through July. And you can see this seasonal cycle where the spring bloom draws down the carbon dioxide and then it goes up. On the other hand, we have about 40 miles away, we have a Selwagen Observatory. So exactly the same time that this carbon dioxide at the surface started to go down, the carbon dioxide at the bottom started to go up. And I can test you on this later as to why that is. But you can see that it's a fairly close linked system, we think. And so what we wonder, if an organism was born in May, okay, so in which some are, when the water temperature gets to a certain point, it's brought into the world in an environment that's got a fairly high omega, fairly low PCO2. Our atmospheric PCO2, by the way, is 400, so anything below that is favorable for shellfish. And so let's say this thing drifted along and it sunk after 3 or 4 weeks, which might be a typical cycle for shell's larvae up in the water column. So this thing faces an environment now where it goes from a PCO2 of 300 up to a PCO2 of 600 or more. And if it was born back here and dropped into this, it may go like 400 or 500 microatmospheres in a month. And that's quite a ride. And for perspective, If we take a historical view from the year 1000 to into 2100, if we take an historical view of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, it just kind of didn't change at all until humans started burning coal. And you can see this is our period of observations, and through here, this blue band, and here are various projection scenarios from the IPCC, and here we're living right in here somewhere right now. But this organism, in just a month, would go from, you know, 250 up to almost 600. And that's a range similar to 100 years or more of acidification from increasing PCO2. So there's a lot of variability that we need to understand in the Gulf of Maine that we're not capturing right now, that we're not able to put into our models right now. So the conclusions are the Gulf of Maine is quite sensitive to OA for the reasons I talked about. It's influenced by several processes that can be affected at different time scales. And we're probably already seeing trends in acidification. I want to thank the NOAA OAP program who funds us now. A lot of this was started by other NOAA work, and we've been funded primarily by NASA for the last 7 years, NSF, and NIRCUS, who helps us operate the buoy.